folks, when is it going to stop? When you've got a robber and thief, you don't cater to them and say, listen, we're going to let you take the silver this time, but leave the gold, okay, because we like the gold. Folks, nonsense and poppycock. Absolute insanity. I don't understand. By the way, our guest is up with us. Let's introduce him now, and that's Eustace Mullins. Good evening, Eustace.
Oh, good evening there.
I was talking in regard to the China-U.S. missile agreement. And
oh, yeah.
We're giving a little bit, they're giving a little bit, and my point is that, you know, they have already violated agreements. They've already helped aggressor nations, third world countries that, quite frankly, are very unfriendly towards us, and they've threatened us themselves. I don't think you need to come to a compromise or an agreement with someone like that. You have to take a hard line and say, here's a hard line, don't cross it.
That's right, and you never give up your principles in dealing with that kind of situation.
Yeah, no, we keep sacrificing lives, we keep sacrificing principles, and quite frankly, folks, it's a heinous situation. Eustace and I are going to discuss one of his books tonight, by the way, The Curse of Canaan. We're going to do, there's no way we can discuss it in a single E, but I want to give a brief overview of it as we can. I don't even know whether or not we'll even get to the 11th chapter or whatever, Eustace, but I'm really honored. Again, you're one of my heroes, and I appreciate the opportunity to take somebody that has given so much great information to the world and simply only ask that they use it. I'm really appreciative of you, Eustace. In the meantime, it's break time. We'll be back right after this. Bill Brumbaugh, Eustace Mullins, and The Curse of Canaan. We're back. Eustace, I can't remember a time in my life, and maybe in modern recorded history here, where we have seen more earth-shaking events and things happen at such a phenomenal rate. Then again, I wasn't around during World War II. I was born in 54. I wasn't around during the Great Depression. And those are times when a lot of things were fast-breaking, a lot of hearts were aching, and again, you know, it's always, well, things are going to be better. We have a new paradigm we're moving to. It's just the same old thing, just revised, revived, and rolled out once again.
Well, you're absolutely on target because the fact is we're moving into a new period of history. We're just completed 25,000 years, a total solar orbit. And now we're moving into an acceleration of knowledge, of power, of energy. In other words, the people of the world are on the verge of a great adventure, which is just starting. And, of course, you haven't seen any evidence of this in the media. They know nothing about any of this because, of course, they know nothing about anything.
Well, they seem to know when to keep their mouth shut and what not to say at the right time or wrong time. You know, when you mentioned about the 25,000 years, did you pick up on the story at all about the new comet that they have found?
No, I saw something about it, not much. But we're on a period of great discovery here, a discovery not only of our world but the universe. And this is the most exciting thing. This is why I've been so optimistic over the years. People say to me, Eustace, you've endured everything anybody could endure in your 78 years, and yet you're more optimistic every day. I'm optimistic because I see God is unfolding the world before us, and it's up to us to take notice of it and to benefit by it.
I agree. And even though things look overwhelming and how would I say, the patriot cause looks underwhelming in some ways, the fact is that during times of great economic, social, or fiscal chaos, folks, the bottom line is that we have opportunities. It seems the elite, they're always ready to seize it, but as Christians, I believe it's time we start applying the true principles of stewardship. And I don't know about taking the country back, but doing what we should have been doing for a long time in the name of Christ, and then leaving it up to God whether or not he'll spare his hand of wrath on this nation.
Well, it's not a question, really, of taking the country back. It's a question of stopping people from stealing it from us. That's what we need to do.
I totally agree. Well, your book, The Curse of Canaan, has had a very profound impact on a number of people I know, and And it's a marvelous book. And I'd kind of like to, if we could, give it a little breakdown, go chapter through chapter. Maybe during this short time that we have, 2 hours, we won't have the fullness of the opportunity to explore it anywhere near the depth and the credit I'd like to give it. But I would like to go through it kind of chapter by chapter, if you're amenable to that.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, the subtitle itself, A Demonology of History, what it does is examine the demonic presence of demons in history. And, of course, people say, well, I've never seen any demons, but there is a demonic presence. And what this book does, The Curse of Canaan, traces the demonic presence and how it manifests itself through terrible catastrophes, wars, revolutions, and so forth.
All right, and folks, that is the relevance of it. There is an evil that is profound, and it's always been around, but it seems to be at its apex when things are, at their worst. And that's when Christians need to be shining, folks. That's when we really need to be at our brightest. And I think, again, the information that Eustace has written and penned over the years, you're going to find very relevant. I'm praying these radio shows, again, folks, make copies of them, give them away. I'm hoping Firefighters for Christ will give away another 50,000 copies of an interview I've done. That would be marvelous. Now, obviously, I don't have the finances to do that, neither do you, but they do, and I'm hoping and praying, again, we put a little pressure on them, contact them, and they'll get this information out. So, well, the war against Shem. Now, there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of disillusion in regard to the movement of the tribes, despite the excellent work of Arthur Koestler and others. You know, we have a whole lot of confusion going on, and the war against Shem, I think that clearly defines and aligns why the world situations are as they are in terms of territories. Please give us a breakdown of that, if you would, sir.
Well, the war of Shem comes right from Genesis 9:25, where God cursed Canaan. Cursed be Canaan, a slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers, Shem and Japheth. Well, because the Canaanites were condemned to be slaves of the Semites, the Shem, the descendants of Shem, this is why the war against Shem goes on, because this is the slave rebellion of the Canaanites against the people of Shem.
Well, now, when you say the slave rebellion, and when you say Shem, now, who is Shem nowadays in modern terms?
Well, Shem and Japheth were sons of Noah, and Canaan was Ham's son, who was the grandson of Noah, and it was the grandson, Canaan, who was cursed by God because of transgressions. And that's why he was cursed to be slaves. And from Genesis 9:25 is just as important today as it was when God made that curse many centuries ago.
Well, see, a lot of people look at Christ on the cross and they say, well, that starts a new covenant. Well, folks, that's true, but again, he didn't come to abolish, he came to fulfill. And that's the chill that I get down my spine, because so many people, it's like, oh, we got a whole new gig going, the Old Testament isn't relevant. I submit to you, folks, and I would like to get Eustace's reaction, it's as relevant as it ever was.
Oh, well, Christ on the cross, you know, people do not understand what the significance of Christ is. That is not the defeat of Christ. This is the victory of Christ. And in fact, the Bible says, if ye be Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. So this is the promise, the new covenant. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And this is it says, behold, the days are coming, Jeremiah 31:31. And this is what we have to look forward to. It's not, we don't have to worry about the past. Behold, the days are coming. This is where we are.
Well, and that's interesting because, again, there's a dichotomy going on in our society, and that is that trying to define issues in the Middle East. I mean, folks, that place is so wacky and messed up, it's not funny. But I think the issues in the Middle East were all dependent and contingent upon where the curses were laid, where the promises were kept, where they were broken, and those promises that were immutable and irrefutable. Are they conditional? Well, the bottom line is, folks, that whole thing in the Middle East goes down because no one kept their promise to God.
Exactly. They did not fulfill the covenant. The covenant was there. And, you know, I mentioned in my book, Curse of Canaan, my first revelation was that, quote, God has no secrets from man. You see, God is not keeping secrets from man. Man is keeping secrets from God, and this is where the problem is. God is not hiding things from us. We're hiding things from each other for because of greed and trying to get ahead of other people and so forth. And God has no part of that.
And folks, like you can hide from God, the all-knowing, all-seeing, all-present God of the universe, and yet we do, because we now define God according to our own parameters. You heard of Jack in the Box, folks? We put God in a box. And because of that, because we put finite limitations on him, we think that we can manipulate, we believe that we can hide, and he'll never chide us for it.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And you know what Jesus said? One of his great admonitions was, be not deceived. Be ye not deceived. And because we allow ourselves to be deceived, this is our vulnerability. We have to fight deception and expose deception. And, of course, that's what my work and your work is.
And I think, folks, that is a worthy enterprise, the most worthy enterprise, because that's what Christ asked us to do. Well, now, in regard to the transgression of Cain, I think this is key because, folks, we see symbolism, we see occultism throughout the world today. And I think it's important that we understand the roots and the basis of that. And I believe transgression of Cain gives a lot of clear definition on that.
Oh, it certainly does. And, in fact, I point out that all the conspiracies in history, especially during the last 5,000 years, it's actually different aspects of the same conspiracy. Some people fix on one aspect of the conspiracy and say, this is the problem, others say another thing. But the thing is, all the conspiracies work together. All the conspirators are part of the same operation, and this is what people find very reluctant. They want to fix on what they're looking for is the magic bullet or the silver bullet. If they can only find out which little group it is doing all the devilment, then they can figure out what's going on. Well, it's not that easy because there's a lot going on, and it's a multifaceted operation.
Yeah, it sure is, folks. And again, when you follow back the different conspiracies, when you follow back the different organizational aspects to it, you'll find, folks, all this is intertwined, overlapped, and again, some of the most monumental events in history comes when the two respective agendas, and I say two, folks, there are variants on that, but I like to break it down into two, when they get to a point, folks, where they have to stand off against each other. And that's when things get very interesting. Now, in regard, if you had to break it down, I know John Daniels, who's been a guest on the show, likes to break it down in current terms into two generic categories. One is English Freemasonry and French Freemasonry. I'd like to hear, after the break, how you break it down as to what's going on. Is it pantheistic atheism versus socialistic capitalism? I'd like to get Eustace's definitions. And if you have questions or comments, folks, you can email me now. We're not opening the phones yet. At bill@proactivenews.com. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Eustace Mullins is the author of a number of brilliant books. The one we're talking about tonight is The Curse of Canaan. Folks, I'll be blunt with you on something, too. If you have any books in your library or reference materials, Eustace's books need to be the key of that. They need to be the center of that. And if somebody would like to get a hold of your books, Eustace, get a catalog or listing of them, I believe we didn't have a chance to work together on this yet, but I would like to offer those at my website, proactivenews.com. But in the meantime, if they want to get them right away, how do they do that?
Through the Bankers Research Institute, which is at Box 1105, Stanton, Virginia, 24401.
Okay, again, folks. Eustace, can you give that to us one more time, please?
Yes, indeed. Bankers Research Institute, Box 1105, Stanton, Virginia, 24401. All the books are available through that number.
Okay, great. Now, still in the transgression of Cain, I believe it was page 50 or 51 when you talk about the grand architect. Could you get into that a little bit for us? Because I think, again, Freemasonry is such a key issue to understand.
Yeah, well, Freemasonry actually goes back to Nimrod. You see, Ham's son, Canaan, had a son named Cush, and Cush had a son named Nimrod. Nimrod became the first dictator of the world and a totally evil person who founded Freemasonry and built the legendary Tower of Babel, in defiance of God's will. And because he did this, this became the rebellion against God, which has gone on to the present time. And Nimrod had such tremendous power because Ham had stolen the garments which God made for Adam and Eve before he expelled them from the Garden of Eden. Cush inherited these garments from Ham and passed them on to Nimrod, who became the most powerful man in the world, the mighty hunter, because he had these garments. They gave him tremendous power. And it was because of this power and the use of this power that Nimrod became the dictator of the world, the first ruler of the world.
And folks, that's real important because Olaf Hagee and I have done programs on the power of some of the garments, and we've talked about the robes, we've talked about different artifacts. There was real power in these things.
Total power, yes.
Yeah, and you know, we're not going to get into in-depth and detail that we have in the past, but the folks, you need to realize that you need to understand this. Now, let me ask one quick question. Was this power technological, or was it, I hate to use, I'll use the term supernatural.
At first it was really physical power, more power than other people had, but it really was supernatural power.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that because I know two guys are going to send me emails asking me that question. So I figured we'd just get it out of the way right now. I've got a very well-educated audience. As a matter of fact, I feel my radio audience is probably the finest educated radio audience in the world. So, and it's our goal and opportunity to get them as best educated as possible. Well, now, you also get into the different levels of Freemasonry, and I find that relevant and important, too. Could you give us a little dissertation on that, please?
Freemasonry originated as a world movement because Nimrod, even though he was the ruler of the world, was finally killed by Shem, and Shem then chopped his body up into small pieces in order to lessen his power. And these pieces were hidden by the priest in the forest. And because they were hidden, the priests were the only ones who knew where the pieces of the body were buried. And this is the old saying, he knows where the body is buried. And that goes back to the origins of Freemasonry. The priests were the Gnostics, and the Gnostics knew where the pieces of the body were, and that's where their power came from. And this was the how Freemasonry became a world power and has continued to be a world power to the present day.
And Gnosticism, boy, there's a subject for...
Gnosticism, yes.
Yeah, we can do an entire show on that.
Oh, you certainly could.
Yeah, not to even scratch the surface. Well, Chapter 3, you talk about secular humanism, and I do find a relationship there from my particular view of Gnosticism and secular humanism. Can you take us through Chapter 3 a little bit, please?
Yes, indeed. Well, secular humanism, people talk about secular humanism today, but they don't really know what it is. It's a transitional power of Freemasonry, which went, as I say, after the secret hiding places of the body of Nimrod gave rise to Freemasonry as a world power.
And we'll have to break at that point. We do have a commercial coming up in 8 seconds. I lost time of the clock. We'll be back in just a minute. All right, we're back, my friend. Go ahead.
Oh, well, secular humanism, I found the formula for secular humanism, which, as I say, is the transitional period of Freemasonry and the descendants of Nimrod. And I got it out of the Babylonian Talmud, of all places. where it was the will of Canaan. When Canaan died, he left instructions for his heirs as to how they should conduct their lives and their operations. And it says, five things did Canaan charge his sons. Love one another, that is, the criminals should love each other but hate everybody else. Love one another, love robbery, love lewdness, hate your masters, and do not speak the truth. Well, we saw that on television last night when Connie Chung interviewed Gary Condit. He followed every principle of that. And this is actually the operating instructions which politicians use in this country. They love robbery, love lewdness, hate your masters. They hate their masters because, of course, under the curse of Canaan, they were supposed to be slaves. And do not speak the truth. And, of course, they never do. And this is the code of secular humanism, and this is the way that they control other people, because law-abiding, Christian, hard-working people find it impossible to believe that these Canaanites can live like this, that they can love robbery, love lewdness, hate your masters, and do not speak the truth, because this is not the way ordinary people live. And so it gives them a freedom to carry on their criminal operations, because the average person cannot believe that people live like this.
And that's the truth of it. That is so far beyond us. But, folks, that is the way it is. And I found Condit. We just got through with Bill Clinton, and now we're getting the same thing from Condit. I'm really hoping it'll do some severe damage to the Democratic Party. And maybe the Republicans...
Well, they very well may. You know, they were going to rerun him, and now after his disastrous appearance, I think they're having second thoughts.
Well, hopefully they're having second, third, and fourth thoughts on that one.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but anyways, okay. Well, you know, one of the things I found about secular humanism, being a formerly, I was proud to be an atheist, even though everybody has some sort of belief system, they have some sort of religion. It's incumbent in the nature of man, even if it's a religion and not believing in any religion. That, too, folks, is defined as a belief system. Secular humanism left me without help. It left me without hope. And I do know that as I went through my life and dealing with some of the media people that I did, movie stars and others, you get to a point where you see these people that are at the pinnacle of their art or profession or on the rise up, and they're more shallow, they're more lost than anyone else you'll meet the rest of your entire life. Apart from a God, I believe I probably would be dead now because, frankly, I wouldn't have any reason to go on.
Oh, yes. Oh, it is a hopeless situation because they have to give up everything that anybody wants to believe in. And, in fact, secular humanism, which is now totally in charge of our education, wants you to give up honor and integrity and loyalty and become like the Canaanites. Hate your masters, love lewdness, love robbery. And when that takes over the educational system, which we have seen it do, now, you know, all these schools in the United States were founded by Christians, including Reverend John Harvard, Harvard University, which is now a cesspool of homosexuality and left-wing insanity. Well, all these schools were founded by Christians, but by the year 1900, John Dewey and this crowd of secular humanism moved in and took over the entire educational system. And they banned honor and integrity and learning and made it part of the conspiracy.
And folks, again, if there's no hope, if there's no rock-solid values on which to build your future, understand it all degenerates down into chaos. I think that that is really the conclusion I have from secular humanism. It will degenerate into chaos.
Yes, indeed.
Well, in Chapter 4, you discuss England. Now, I do a lot of discussing of England. I find them disgusting because although people around the world like to say, well, England is nothing more than America's satellite. It is absolutely the antithesis, folks. The United States is not too much more than a headless body getting its orders from Britain.
Well, it does, but that's because the Freemasons, the Duchy of Hanover, took over the throne of England in 1717 and set up Freemasonry as the ruling force in England, and we're directed by England because of Freemasonry. Now, most people think that England was the origin of the United States, but in fact, we rebelled against England. 52% of the inhabitants of the United States were of German descent. And so in World War One and World War Two, our logical predilection would have been to fight with Germany against England. But because of the Freemasonry, we were lured into coming in on England's side and fighting the Germans of the 52% of the people of the United States.
Now, that's interesting. I didn't know. Well,
Germany missed by one vote being the national language of the United States instead of England.
Now, it missed by one vote? Oh, my goodness.
One vote only, because many of the American settlers spoke German and were from Germany, and they wanted to the German as the national language of the United States after the Revolution. And it missed by one vote, and that's why we're speaking English today.
Now, that is fascinating. Again, prior to the information I received from you, I was not aware that we had that many Germans. As a matter of fact, that's kind of a little-known thing in the history books. I don't find
that. Oh, it isn't mentioned at all. And I knew it because I have many German friends in New York, and one of my best friends was George Sylvester Viereck, whose father was the illegitimate son of Kaiser Wilhelm I, and because of that family background, Sylvester became the leader of the German-Americans of the United States in the 1920s and 30s, and he represented Germany during both World Wars, but he was very incompetent. He was a poet and not a propagandist, and so he was probably the real reason why we went in on the side of England instead of Germany.
Of course, now, when you say that, it conjures up images that maybe we need to define a little bit, because a lot of people might think, well, now, hold it. You're talking about backing Hitler, right?
In the first war, it was the Kaiser, and the Kaiser happened to be Sylvester Viereck's first cousin. You would have been backing the Kaiser, that's true.
No, and I was being facetious there with
yeah.
Hitler.
No, we wouldn't have been backing
Kaiser,
Hitler, of course not.
Yeah, no, Kaiser Wilhelm, though, he was a very interesting man, and I find that also fascinating that the history books have almost completely eliminated any talk or any mention about Kaiser Wilhelm or what he was up to or his faith.
Well, he was demonized by British propagandists during World War One, and it was so successful that I don't think Kaiser Wilhelm ever regained his status as a world leader
to this day. Yeah, and now the nature of that was, wasn't he a bit rebellious towards the forces of Freemasonry, Kaiser Wilhelm?
Oh, he was indeed, and Hitler was too, by the way. Hitler banned Freemasonry in the Nazis, and of course, and the Nazi regime, and of course that's another reason that he's demonized again today, because he, I think he closed down, and Mussolini closed down the Freemason lodges in Italy also. So this made them the enemy.
Well now, so that raises some questions then. Now, I know, I've read Douglas Reed's work, and folks, Douglas Reed was a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, or I should say photojournalist, when he was with the London Times, wasn't he?
Yes, Douglas Reed was one of the preeminent journalists of the world during his period. He's totally forgotten now. Of course, he's been blacked out, actually. But his books are very powerful.
They sure are. As a matter of fact, though, I think many or most of them are no longer available here in the United States. I think that is part of the stuff that's hit the banned book list.
Oh, it is, and that's why they're available through rare book dealers. That's about the only place you can find them.
And, yeah, no, as a matter of fact, I was trying to bid on one of his books in California. It was a second edition book, and the guy wanted an outrageous amount of money for it, and I was trying to act as a broker for another guy to pick it up, but they just wanted too much. And they didn't care what was in it. It was just that they knew the book had been banned, and they knew it had some value.
Well, they knew it was in demand. That was the thing. It was scarce. It's rare.
Yeah, and we should probably back off of that subject for now to stay chronological and get to, we talked about Ng a little bit. Now, what about the French Revolution? Because, again, history kind of is sketchy on the French Revolution, and those of us that are a little bit more intimate on what actually happened, you know, that was a major deal, in my opinion, the French Revolution. It definitely was one of the most manipulative revolutions in history.
Oh, it certainly was. Well, both the rebellion against the Kaiser, or the war against the Kaiser, and the war against the French king in the French Revolution were part of the war against the Semites, the descendants of Shem. And both of those aristocracies were wiped out.
Well, yeah, and basically, again, through the forces of Masonry, tied in with the international bankers, correct?
Yes, and of course, in the French Revolution, you had a concerted effort to exterminate the descendants of Shem and the French aristocracy.
Well,
but they called it liberty, equality, and fraternity, and liberty, equality, and fraternity was simply a code word for wiping out the descendants of Shem.
Well, yeah, and the manipulation that went on was rather interesting. I mean, I believe at one time during the French Revolution, didn't the peasants storm the palace and the king came out by himself, talked to him, and said, "What's your problem? I mean, you know, I'm a good king, and haven't I done this and that?" And they actually walked away and backed down?
Oh, yes, because he had been a good king. But later on, in the French Revolution, this is a very little-known fact, the principal victims of the French Revolution were not the aristocracy, they were the peasants. The peasants were massacred because after the Jacobins, or the Rothschild agent, took over, they executed King Louis and Marie Antoinette, and they took over the country, and then they began to exterminate the peasants because they did the same thing that Stalin did in the 1930s in Russia. They exterminated the peasants because the peasants wouldn't turn all their grain to these criminals that took over the country.
Mm.
And the peasants, the amount of aristocrats killed in France was very small compared to the massacres of the peasants, which were hundreds of thousands of people.
Well,
you won't read that in any history book either.
No, you don't. And I was a bit of a student of history, too. Of course, it was PC history, politically correct history. So, again, very interesting. Well, we go for the French Revolution, and I know that we had... there was a lot of sympathy, supposedly, from France in regard to the American Revolution that took place over here. And, you know, I always wonder the nature of that sympathy. I mean, you know, you get through having your revolution and you got all sorts of stuff going on, and then all of a sudden you're buddies or you want to help out America. It just didn't seem right to me. You'd think they want to kick back and pick up the pieces of their own country, and yet again, I've heard there was sympathy from the French towards the Americans. I always felt that that was kind of a veil, and there was some other agenda why the French were so eager to help the Americans.
Oh, there was, because our principal representative in France who helped set that up was Benjamin Franklin, who was a leading Freemason. And it was Franklin's influence with the Freemasons in France which brought about the support of the Americans in their war against England. And of course, England was a Freemason country also, but you had the French Freemasons and the English Freemasons were at that time sort of rivals, because the Grand Orient was in France, the Grand Orient lodges, and they were rivals of the York Rite of Freemasonry, which is in England. And it was that rivalry which really led to the colonists winning the war, the revolution, in the 1780s.
Very interesting, very interesting. Again, folks, I guarantee you won't hear any of that in a history book.
Not a word of it, no.
Well, now the Civil War. Let's get into the Civil War a bit. What were the circumstances behind that, please? The real circumstances.
Well, the real Civil War, the circumstances of the Civil War originated because the Rothschilds decided that America was growing too fast and becoming too powerful as a world power, and so they decided to split it into two smaller countries to balkanize it, and they did this through the issue of slavery. They set up the abolitionist movement in New England, and the bankers there spent millions of dollars to promote abolition or the freeing of the slaves. But in order to have the Civil War, they had to create a Southern army. There was no army of the Southern states. In other words, we only had the United States Army in Washington, D.C., based in Washington, D.C. So the Rothschilds spent millions of dollars sending Freemasons through the South in order to organize local hunting clubs and shooting clubs, which became the basis of the Confederate Army. And this was all done from Cincinnati by the Knights of the Golden Circle, which was the branch of the Illuminati, which set up the whole Civil War. In other words, we would never have had a Civil War because you cannot have a war when only one side has an army. So the Knights of the Golden Circle out of Cincinnati traveled through the South for 18 years, setting up paramilitary groups throughout all the Southern states, and that became the Confederate Army.
Mm. So I keep seeing the hand of Freemasonry, which, again, that's simply the modern delineation, isn't it? It wasn't always known as Freemasonry.
No, it wasn't. Came under various guises. Well, Masonry itself, you know, was actually the builder's trade during the Middle Ages, and these people were builders. They were stonemasons and carpenters, but then it took on a mystical aspect through what they call speculative Freemasonry, and speculative Freemasonry was no longer builders and carpenters, but they were teachers and intellectuals and revolutionaries and so forth. In other words, Masonry underwent a tremendous transformation when the House of Hanover took over the British throne in 1700.
Well, we're going to hold it right there, and Bordoff, I need to talk to you, too, if I could. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. You know, friends, there's so many fascinating facts about the American Revolution. I find it amazing. I believe the British had, in Georgetown, several thousand troops stationed for an extended period of time after we allegedly won the Revolutionary War.
Oh, I think so. And also, the judges of the United States continued, after we won the Revolutionary War, the judges in our courts continued to rule in favor of the English. In other words, all of the loans and mortgages that the Bank of England and British lords had over the American people, the judges upheld that they had to be paid in full.
So
and that's
a little
known fact of history also.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if we really did win the war, because it seems like financially we lost, and we lost big time.
We lost big time, and they set up the first bank of the United States. The first central bank of the United States was set up in 1787, at the very time that we were establishing our Constitution.
Now, that's interesting. I was not aware of that.
Well, Thomas Jefferson opposed it. But George Washington, who was then the president, and Thomas Jefferson was Secretary of State, Jefferson bitterly opposed it, but Washington agreed and signed the charter of the First Bank of the United States. But when that expired in 1812, Jefferson was the president, and he refused to renew it, and this is why the British attacked the United States again, and the only reason in the history books for the War of 1812 is that Jefferson refused to renew the charter of the central bank, the first bank of the United States, and you won't find that in any history book either.
No, as a matter of fact, you don't find hardly anything about the War of 1812.
Oh, no, because they won't tell you why it started. It started because Jefferson refused to renew the charter of the first bank of the United States. And you won't find that at Harvard, and you won't find it at Yale, or you won't find it at Princeton. Your children can go there, and you can spend all the money getting an education, and they won't hear one word about the true history. I really have to write the history of the United States, because it is all the wars are bankers' wars, and all of the government operations are the conspiracies of the international bankers.
Yeah, I was going to say about the only thing I remember from 1812 prior to being educated and motivated as an adult was a very dynamic piece written by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky.
Oh, yes, the 1812 origin.
Yeah, that was about it. Interesting. And folks, again, the Civil War now... I mean, the War of 1812. Now, how much influence did that have in the Civil War? I mean, folks, wars are preluded by wars. They're segues. They're bridges into the next war. I mean, and that's where we were going next. The Civil War, the bloodiest, most costly war in U.S. history, and a war that neither side won.
Oh, no, but everybody lost because the bloodletting in this country was terrible. And it was the greatest bloodletting per capita of any country in the world. It was a massacre on both sides.
Mm.
Well, look, at Gettysburg alone, Lee continued to send the Confederate troops up against the pickets charge and so forth when the Union had already overwhelmingly established the control of the bluffs and hills around Gettysburg. And Lee simply wiped out the Southern Army right there at Gettysburg.
Now, that was weird. That was almost like a setup. I was sitting there thinking...
It seemed very strange, yeah.
Yeah, Lee was not a dummy. I mean, he was a very competent military man. And yet, folks, again, you tell your people to go do something stupid. You got to wonder, which side was he working for? And we're going to pick it up at the top of the hour. We've got a minute and a half break for station ID. We'll be back right at the top. In regard to the title of the book, how does the Civil War fit in with that, Eustace?
Well, as I say, the Rothschilds decided in 1838 to split the country into two smaller Balkanized countries. And when Lincoln fired on... When Lincoln was supposedly defending the Federal Republic against the South, because the South fired on Fort Sumter. Now, that was all a setup because Charleston, South Carolina, was the headquarters of the Scottish Rite in the United States, and was the most Masonic city in the United States. And this attack on Fort Sumter was entirely organized by Freemasons in Charleston, which gave Lincoln the pretext to declare war on the South. You know, the Southern states were not looking for war. They had peacefully seceded from the Union, as they were entitled to do under the provisions of the Constitution. There was absolutely no reason for a war, and Lincoln himself forced the war on the United States.
Well, now that's interesting, because, again, that's a perspective that is not often shared on the air. I keep seeing the same scenario. It's almost as if everybody is playing each other, that it's one big cosmic play going on, and the actors and actresses have ad lib capabilities within certain parameters, but basically they're acting almost according to script.
They really are, and the script is written by the conspirators. As I say, the people in the North and the people in the South were not particularly anxious to have war. You know, wars are very hard to start. It takes a lot of organizing and conspiracy to start a war and get millions of people to kill each other. You know, they had the, during the Civil War in New York City, they had the riots against conscription, and hundreds of people were killed because the northern people were not as crazy about continuing the war against the South. And that's not very well covered in history.
Yeah, I have only heard that a couple times in my entire research career, that hundreds of people were killed in protest against forced conscription.
Oh, the Civil War riots in New York and Chicago were tremendous.
Well,
but that's been passed over by the historians.
Well, and conscription was very unpopular, folks. Let's not forget that the British were conscripting our people where they could during the Revolutionary War.
Oh, they certainly were, yes.
And that was a real unpopular thing. And believe me, folks, believe me, that hung very high in the eyes of the people of this country. They didn't like the Brits doing it, and they sure as heck didn't like the North doing it either.
No, indeed.
Now, the South, they weren't working off of forced conscription, were they?
No, but you see, they fought because they were invaded. You see, the South did not invade the North. The North invaded the South. So the people there were defending their homes against invasion, which gave them the will to fight.
And that's another one of those little interesting things that is conveniently left out of the history books as well.
Oh, it certainly is.
Yeah. Folks, that's very relevant. The fact is the South should have been allowed to secede. Why? It's a business. They pulled out of a business partnership. And I don't see it any more clear-cut or plain than that.
No, that's exactly what it was. And, you know, the South actually won the Civil War. They won at the Battle of Manassas, and Washington was totally unprotected. And General Lee could have marched into Washington at any time, and the Civil War would have been over, but he didn't do it, because my feeling is that Lee was always, at his heart, loyal not to the Union, but to the United States, and that he simply did not have it in him to conquer Washington. Do you know that under Lee's leadership, no Confederate soldier ever fired a shot against the city of Washington? Not one.
That's rather odd, folks.
It's rather odd because they won the Battle of Manassas 25 miles from the city of Washington, and they could have walked in there and took it over that same afternoon. They did nothing.
Yeah, that's right. Manassas was so important. Washington had thrown any defense or troops into that defense.
Oh, yes. They were totally wiped out, and they had no defense whatsoever.
And it's break time. We don't have a defense for that either. We'll be right back. Eustace, other things about the Civil War and actually even going back before that, America was a country that, you know, we didn't want to be in a feudal society. We didn't want to have the rich elite to crush us beneath their feet. And yet something started happening out of that, and that was that in addition to the influence of the secret societies, we have a neo-feudal country being formed, because it starts turning out that the sons and daughters of the people that were kind of controlling and messing things up started basically assuming, although they were not officially referred to as titles of nobility, they started inheriting a lot of the duties and a lot of the things that their forerunners had been doing, that their fathers and grandfathers had been doing, to the point today where I see a complete and total neo-feudal society where, you know, we have, again, we've got another Bush in the White House. And who's Clinton? Clinton is a Rockefeller. Why is he a Rockefeller, folks? Because the Rockefellers don't want to reveal themselves as being in that much control, sitting in the number one seat in the nation. The country's not ready for it yet. So they work through shills. They work through their bastard lineage. And this has been going on for a long time now. And I think the Civil War, though, we started seeing a more full and direct manifestation of that.
Oh, we certainly do. And these are family dynasties. And the interesting thing is that these elitists, these family dynasties, arose in a country whose constitution says that every citizen has equal rights, that no citizen can set himself up above another one, and yet these elites rose up and took over the country, and they did it in Civil War, by the way. The elitists did not go to war during the Civil War. You were able to pay $200 and send a substitute to fight for your place in the North when you were drafted. And so none of the wealthy families fought in the Civil War. They simply bought substitutes, J.P. Morgan and all of them. They spent their J.P. Morgan got his start as a financier by buying some condemned rifles from the Union Army and then reselling them back to the War Department at an inflated price, and the rifles didn't even work.
I'm not sure which is worse, the Kennedy family or the Morgans on that one. I mean,
unfortunately about the same kind of people. But they definitely are elitists, and they definitely set themselves over above everyone else. And, in fact, they just announced that Teddy Kennedy is pretty well dead of advanced cirrhosis of the liver because of his depraved lifestyle. He's only 69 years old, but he's supposed to be in a very advanced stage of cirrhosis, and so if he happens to die now, the Republican governor of Massachusetts will appoint a governor, and this will reinstate the Republicans as the majority in the Senate.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. And I know that Ted Kennedy, we can almost spend a little time on Kennedy tonight if you want, as soon as we get through the evolution of this, because we had, I had a really interesting time talking to you on the subject of Kennedy earlier. But let's continue on right now with the book, and maybe we can get to Kennedy, and I guarantee we're going to have a handful of people that are going to want to call in and talk to you too, Eustace. The next chapter in the book, The State of Virginia. Now, I plead ignorant on the state of Virginia. I really don't know why the significance would be ascribed to the state of Virginia, but frankly, given the meritorious import that you've given us on all these other chapters, it must have some relevance.
Oh, it really does. Well, Virginia was known as the mother of presidents because the early presidents of the United States were mostly from Virginia. And as the mother of presidents and the cradle of democracy, Virginia played an inordinate role in the first 100 years of this country. But you see, after the Civil War, we had a punitive government installed in Washington, the federal government, and they maintained martial law in the southern states for 12 years, from 1865 to 1877. And during that time, they installed, under martial law, carpetbagger governments in all the southern states. So the southern states have never really recovered from these criminal governments which were installed under martial law. And in fact, in the state of Virginia where I live now, we have two parties. We have the Democrats and the Republicans. And they're about the same, and I call them the carpetbaggers and the scalawags. The carpetbaggers are the Republicans, and the scalawags are the Democrats. And that's the government that we have in the state today.
Now, prior to the Civil War, was Virginia just one big happy state, or was it broken down into two like it is now, Virginia and West Virginia?
No, indeed. Old Virginia had a marvelous government up till 1860. They produced a great statesman, and they had a very homogenous political establishment. And there was no two-party system in Virginia up till 1860.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I know the next chapter of the book, and I know we're going to have folks. I'll go ahead and give out the phone number now if you'd like to line up your calls. 1-800-259-5791. 800-259-5791. It would be nice to also to get some new faces and some new voices calling in. So, again, that number is 1-800-259-5791. Obviously, we're not going to turn away phone calls, folks, but I would like to hear some of the new folks. And I know we expand this broadcast audience in leaps and bounds, and I like to hear some of you. You don't even necessarily have to agree with us, folks. I mean, discussion and disagreement can be very productive and very practical when it's done in a point-counterpoint format. So give us a call, 1-800-259-5791. Now, the World Wars, you and I kind of went over that last week quite a bit. Again, it's about banking and the fact that they're banking on the public's ignorance in regard to the real cause and causative agents involved in a war.
Well, that's true, and you know, no historian has ever presented a plausible reason why World War I occurred or why World War II occurred. And I'm in this work today because I met a political prisoner, Ezra Pound, who became curious about the origins of World War I after so many of his young friends, writers and artists in London and Paris, died in World War I, and he decided to find out what was the reason they died? What did they die for? And he found out that they died because the international bankers needed a war to create debt. Wars create more debt than anything else. And when they create debt, then everybody has to pay interest to the bankers. And this was the only reason for World War I. And, of course, World War II was simply a rerun of World War I. Same parties, same reasons, everything right down the line.
Well, now, folks, to get a grip or perspective on the monies that were involved and the tremendous interest and everything, it takes, I believe, to pay off the Civil War, it took over 100 years for us to repay those loans, or correct
me if I'm
wrong.
Oh, yes, it did. Tremendous debt. And the succeeding generations don't even realize that they're working to pay the interest and some of the principal on the wars which happened many decades before they were even born.
Folks, yeah, do you understand? I mean, that is indentured servitude at a... I mean, I'll take it a step further. That's bond servitude, folks. Because
that's bondage.
When we don't
when
we don't stand against it, that means we're accepting it tacitly, folks. We're not to do that. My Bible says I'm a bond... If indeed I surrender my life to the Most High God, I am a bond servant of His. You can't serve two masters. What do you think, folks? You go to one master and say, hey, I'm your loyal, good, and faithful servant. Then you go to the other and say the same thing. Don't you understand that both masters are going to be a little bit unhappy with you? I mean, sometimes I just wonder if people understand. Again, that's getting caught between the proverbial frying pan and the fire. I don't think, if I'm going to be a Satanist, I'm going to be the best Satanist I can. I'm not going to dilly-dally around try and jump back and forth. And, well, let me be a Christian today and a Satanist tomorrow. Conversely, folks, when we serve the Most High God, the most worthy and just cause in existence, given the fact that He has already accepted the burden for all of our sins on the cross, don't you think it makes sense that we need to apply ourselves as fully as humanly, respectively, humanly able? I mean, it's only logical, folks. A few years here with an eternity with the Most High God, I think I like the eternity with the Most High God better than a quick passage south to hell. Well, Your chapter 10, you get into the menace of communism. And again, folks, if you'd like to call in, 1-800-259-5791, 800-259-5791, you get into the menace of communism. And I know we've got a break coming up here in 15 seconds. We'll start getting some music. I'd like to pick it up at that point if we could. Okay, Eustace?
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, folks, again, it is break time. Hang in there. We've got a lot more to share here on the air, a lot more of which we feel you need to be made aware. We'll be right back. The menace of communism, what does it really mean?
Well, you know, when I got out of the Air Force in 1946, I became a very dedicated anti-communist, and it took me 20 years to find out that by studying the Federal Reserve System, that the Federal Reserve System was the backer of communism. Our Federal Reserve System here in the United States, principally the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is the money center bank, was almost the sole backer of the world communist movement. And that was a great shock to me. And I found out later that the United States government had been the sole backer of communism since 1917, when President Woodrow Wilson took $20 million of his $100 million special war fund to prosecute World War One, which is voted him by Congress, of this World War One fund to prosecute the war, he took $20 million and sent his Secretary of State, Elihu Root, to Russia in 1917 to rescue the Bolshevik Revolution, which was collapsing. And we have supported the Russians ever since. All during the 40 years of the Cold War, we were keeping Russia alive. The Russian economy had collapsed. But we weren't allowed to know that because the Central Intelligence Agency, our supposedly spy agency in Washington, its sole function during the Cold War was to continue warning the American people about the menace of communism, that Russia was going to take over the world, and at the same time, we were the sole support of Russia. That was to keep the military-industrial complex running this country.
Well, I guess if you don't have a boogeyman, there's no reason to be afraid of the night.
Well, it's like Senator Vandenberg said. He told his fellow senators, and I have it quoted, he said, the only way we can keep this going is to scare the hell out of the American people. And so the menace of communism was promoted by the Central Intelligence Agency for 40 years and kept the Cold War going when there was no Cold War and the Russians were barely able to feed themselves, much less fight us.
Mm. And again, folks, that was another control factor. Why did we just help the military? Well, the same reason Saddam Hussein got that bolstering, folks, is because, again, the people are easily controlled through food, folks. So if we're supplying arms, if we're supplying technology to the respective countries, that country then controls the people itself, thus making it look like these dictatorships are so powerful, so strong, they're so evil. But folks are only evil because we feed the beast.
Well, we feed them because the United States today is still the greatest producer in the world, and nobody can really have any political movement anywhere. When we fought, the last people we fought were Saddam's Iraq army in 1990, and we had President Bush, and Saddam Hussein was President Bush's partner in the Harkin Oil Company, and here he is denouncing his business partner as the new Hitler and declaring war against him, and they were in business together.
Well, now that whole thing was interesting. Plus, I mean, they had a business partnership, too, in regard to the Denver International Airport.
Oh, they certainly did, yes.
Yeah, and so, folks, again, it's just a big global play. It's the old quote, all the world's a stage and we're only players, folks. We're not just players. We're being played left and right. And because we don't fight the good fight, this keeps going on and on and on. These are the Energizer bunnies, folks. They never run out of this energy. They just keep going on and on and on. Folks, that's why programs like this, I pray, are important, should be important to you, that our homeschooling parents will utilize the opportunity to access our internet archives or folks, to make it part of their program where they just tape the show every night and get the education in the hands of the kids, folks, because this is not airy-fairy stuff. This is documented. It is cemented in the blood of the people who have died, allegedly in the name of justice and freedom in this country, too often the need for greed by elitist bankers. Well, Eustace, let's get to the phone lines if we could.
Oh, certainly.
And we'll do that. I think we'll wait till after the break. We'll get to you, Kate, real quick. We'll get to Ken. And Gary, you said an interesting perspective and question on the Internet. We'll get to you as well, folks. Get them lined up. 1-800-259-5791. 800-259-5791. We'll be right back. Eustace Mullins, we've got some callers on the line. Let's get to the first caller, Kate from New Jersey. Good evening, Kate.
Good evening, Mr. Brimball and Mr. Eustace Mullins.
Good evening.
Mr. Mullins, I must tell you, I have most of your books. The only one I think I don't have is about Christ, which you had said it's hard to get. Is that still in print?
It's out of print right now. I'm trying to reprint it now.
Uh-huh. But the most marvelous is your monograph. And the best monograph that I am reading at this present moment is called The Secret Holocaust. And I believe that the truth is in this book, and that is why we have the horrible genocide the world over.
That's
and
true.
I think this book is more important than any of your books, Mr. Mullins. And I really appreciate your information, and the truth should be told. And God bless you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a good testimony. Thank you very much, Kate. When you're talking the Holocaust, now that brings up a number of different possibilities. Are we talking the loss of human life through abortion, or do we get back to the official political designation of what the Holocaust is? And again, I do not believe, and here we go, are we ready? Are you listening, ACLU? I don't believe that there are historic records, factual records, that can document the death of 6 million Jews in Europe at that time. I believe that number to be greatly inflated. It doesn't mean that death or loss of a few hundred thousand people is not a horrible event, but the nature of the circumstances, folks, that's where history has been omitted.
Well, The Secret Holocaust is one of our most popular books, and which is also out of print right now.
And it's one I'm not familiar with, too, so...
The secret Holocaust is the war against the Christianity, a worldwide war against Christianity. Not the war against Jews, but the war against Christianity. And this is why the Anti-Defamation League calls me a Holocaust denier, because my book, The Secret Holocaust, does not mention the Holocaust against the Jews at all. And they claim because I don't mention it, that means I'm a Holocaust denier. How you can deny something without mentioning it, I don't know.
That which is real interesting. Well, you know, and the Holocaust against Christians, I mean, a lot of people are not really cognizant of how many people died, how many Christians died after the Bolshevik Revolution and through Lenin and Marx and Khrushchev.
And the Spanish Civil War, that was a war against Christianity. And also the French Revolution was a war against Christianity. They massacred priests and nuns all over France.
Hmm. And then again, in the classic Machiavellian, or maybe I should say Gramsci, scenario, the very implementers of the revolution were themselves put under the knife too, weren't they?
Oh, they were indeed. That's where they said the terror devoured its own. There's a lot of famous sayings about the French Revolution, and one of them is that Robespierre and many of the others were devoured by their own mechanism.
And folks, if you don't understand the relevance of that, let's put it in modern terms. There has been a recent revolution in this country. It has been a sexual revolution. It's been a social revolution where homosexuality is now a preferred, according to the mainstream media, it's a preferred lifestyle. It is a quote-unquote natural form of birth control. And the activists that were involved with blood terrorism. I know that many cities were threatened, and folks, you don't hear this in the mainstream news, but we have put it out for years. They were terrorized with, if you don't bow to our agenda, we're going to come in and mass donate blood into your blood banks and destroy your blood supply. We're talking about HIV-tainted blood.
Oh, yes, indeed. And in fact, the promotion of homosexuality is part of the war against Christianity because Christianity is a religion which promotes the family unit. And, of course, the promotion of homosexuality is war against the family unit and Christianity.
Agreed. And yet, in their blindness, in their lack of clear sight as to what's really going on, they don't recognize that this is the same old agenda. Folks, AIDS is curable. Just about any ailment known to mankind is curable. And yet, the mainstream medical community, because they help promote the concept of homosexuality as a preferable or superior lifestyle, the homosexuals accept that as a given, and they don't look and see what is happening to their ranks, because quite frankly, just like the French Revolution, just like the Night of the Long Knives in Germany, the implementers of the most radical social revolution then fall under the knife. The homosexuals
certainly do. It devours its own.
Yep, and they're rotting. Their bodies are rotting, folks. This is not a good thing. Understand that, because I would rather see people turn around. I'd rather see them come to a knowledge of the saving grace of the Most High God. But the fact is, folks, is that as they turn their back, their bodies turn black with plague, with the plagues that they bring on themselves just through the very lifestyle itself, let alone some virus or bacteria that may or may not be helping further facilitate the horrible destruction that they face in their lives. Well, let's get to our next caller. And by the way, if you'd like to call in, folks, we've got an open line or two, 800-259-5791, 800-259-5791. We know you're out there. Come join us on the air. Let's get to Ken in Virginia. Good evening, Ken.
Good evening, Bill. I want to compliment you on having your guest, who is one of the amazing resources of American not only history, politics, and learning. And I wasn't sure when you were discussing the chapters. Is this from a new book that he has written, outlining the chapters, or is this chapter 10 and so forth? Because I got in, I didn't hear the beginning of the program. And you were discussing the Civil War briefly, and Eustace is too modest. He knows me. He knows who I am. But he is too modest in his speech. And I was thinking on the Civil War, the of the two Rothschild agents, which he's talked about so many times, where you had August Belmont in the north, and you had Judah Benjamin in the south, who was the Secretary of State, and of course nothing ever happened to him after the war. He went back to England
and lived out to ripe old age, where they put Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, in prison, but Judah Benjamin sailed off to England and lived happily ever after.
And the amusing thing that I just recently read about August Belmont was that getting a lot of money from the Rothschilds and helping lend money to the North for building war stuff. But he was interested in racing, and that's where we got Belmont Park from.
Oh yeah,
and
he was a famous race horse.
And so of course that's sort of entertaining, because everybody knows about Belmont Park, but hardly anybody knows about August Belmont and what he really was.
Well, he openly advertised in all the financial records of that time as that he was the American representative of the Rothschilds, but he failed to tell his customers that the Rothschilds also had two other major representatives who were secret, and that was J.P. Morgan Company and Kuhn Loeb Company in New York. J.P. Morgan was for the Gentiles, and Kuhn Loeb was an all-Jewish company, and so if you were Jewish or Gentile, you still dealt with the Rothschilds through these secret representatives, and August Belmont was the only one who ever identified himself as the actual agent of the Rothschilds.
Now, getting back to my original question, were you discussing, is this a new book?
Curse of Canaan was published in 1987.
Oh, uh-huh.
But it's just as timely right now as when it was first published.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
None of the facts have changed.
And let me interrupt for a second, Ken. I find it a very foundational book because it gives a pretty good layout of the manipulation of this nation and other nations. And then I kind of see a lot of other stuff fitting in and linking in with it from there. But if you don't know who the conspirators are and you don't have a thread that is going between the different fabrics of delusionment and the veils of deception that they put up, then it's really hard to understand how one single entity like the Federal Reserve or the IRS or our military is managing to mess us over so bad. I do believe that the outline and the format of Curse of Canaan is really important. I see it as a real foundational book, Eustace. Ken, back to you.
Yeah, I'll get off. It is a wonderful book, and all the others are too. And Eustace, we just can't repay the debt that we owe him for his wonderful work. I'll get off the line.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
I've got two things. First of all, Board, I missed the name of the caller from Utah. You can tell me anytime. Okay, and second. And is my board op good or what? I already know. Second, here's an interesting statement from a man. He doesn't have a question here, but I'd like to read this if I could, Eustace. He said, the First Bank of the United States, Andrew Jackson did not renew the charter.
That was the Second Bank of the United States. First Bank of the United States was not renewed by Thomas Jefferson, and the second one in 1836 was not renewed. What Andrew Jackson did, he said, you are vipers and I will drive you out. And so he removed the government deposits from the Second Bank of the United States, and that caused it to collapse because they were using the government money to operate their bank.
Mm.
And then that brought on the panic of 1837 by the Bank of England, which refused to honor any American paper anywhere in the world, and that caused the first great financial panic in the United States, the Panic of 1837.
Followed up nearly a century later with the second one, the great stock market crash.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Well, okay. That set the pattern for the panics that followed later. They learned how to do it in the Panic of 1837. And the Rothschilds themselves then, after the panic in the United States, they sent in their representatives to buy up all the stocks of American companies at 1 cent on the dollar, and they created a whole new class of millionaires who were Rothschild's agents, and they were the most powerful people in the United States after 1837.
Okay, and I'm not going to get into the guy's whole question here because I'm going to address that on a later show with my dear friend Greg Pappas. But coming up very soon, folks. But I've got a question for you. Now, I was told by the grandson of Adoniah Rothschild in a meeting that we had a number of years ago, he said, you guys always follow the men. He said, what you don't follow is where the women, where the Rothschild women end up. And he said, that is a trail that I think you'll find most worthy if you investigate.
Oh, yeah, that's very important.
Yeah, now I have not read all your books, but... Do you introduce that factor at all? Because, again, you know, I do find that relevant. We do keep an eye on the males, but the women, again, they give those ties and links into the agenda just through their bloodline as they marry males from other lines.
Oh, yeah. One of the leaders of a British foreign office for in the 19th century was Lord Rosebery, who married Hannah Rothschild. And the Rosebereys are... supposedly a Gentile family, but it's a Rothschild relation.
That's interesting. You know, it's almost as if they marry off the women to achieve either political or financial conquest to spread the Rothschild empire.
Well, they do because, you see, the Rothschilds would never allow a female member to be a partner of the Rothschild banking house, but the women married very prominent aristocrats in England and became powerful that way.
And that's interesting, folks, because we know the British East India Company was involved not just in opium, but slave trade. And who runs the British East India Company, Houston?
Oh, that's the Rothschild operation.
Yeah, that's the Rothschild operation. Folks, the point about this is not only were they trading in slaves, not only were they trading in strange flesh, flesh that was not of their bloodline, but through the marriage of the women... they were trading in flesh through their own family. In my opinion, that is a completely depraved mentality.
Oh, it certainly is.
All right. Well, let's get to our next caller, and that is Rose in Utah. Good evening, Rose.
Hi there. Speaking of the women, do either of you know when the modern-day so-called Jews started tracing their bloodline through the women, since clearly in the Bible it's through the men?
Yes.
Do you know when they started that?
Oh, I don't know exactly when that started, but I think it started after 1700 when the Freemasons became very powerful in England, and England was the leading world power at that time.
I think it has to be a modern invention, because
yes,
it's certainly not biblical.
Yes.
If I can offer one up too, Rose, Greg Pappas will have some insight on that when he comes up, I believe, this next week, but I might throw this out. Due to the complete history that, and there was some very good history and very good records, and now due to the printing press and other things, more of this history became available, it may be that they made this switch by bringing the women as the relevant factor on tracing the bloodline, because the fact is that in 70 A.D., I believe the entire Levitical priesthood was wiped out in Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
meaning there was never a chance again for the temple sacrifices to be performed, meaning that unless Messiah had already come, the Jews never had any hope again.
Well, they certainly don't have the sacrifices today, do they?
No, they don't, and they can't righteously revive them because, again, the Levitical priesthood, I believe, was wiped out. What's your thoughts on that, Houston? I believe that, too,
because that was a very powerful force against the Jews at that time.
Well, and I know I'm quite frankly speculating on that, but it does seem, you know, with the invention of the Gutenberg, with the printing press and all the things that came out of that, now all of a sudden more text, more information is available to the regular public in order to defer and defray away from certain things like finding out that the belief system of modern Judaism can never come to fulfillment without Messiah already having returned. He already would have had to return. They would lose their power. They would lose so much of their control because all their priests were dead. The priests, the temple priests, they were the Levites. If the Levitical line was wiped out at that point, well, then the only way you can try and work around that is through the women.
Well, I figured the women thing has something to do with the money thing, but I can't figure it out exactly how that works. You know, keeping the power in the group.
You mean kind of a checks and balances thing?
Yeah. I want to tell you, you know that horrible suicide bombing they had at the disco or where the young people were killed?
Oh, yes.
Three of those young people, although they were Jews, could not be buried on Jewish soil, on public soil, because they weren't Jewish enough.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Their mothers weren't Jewish.
And are we talking of a belief system, or are we talking of a race, folks? You can't have it both ways. Hang on, Rose. We'll be back for the close right after this. It hardly seems like we just started, Eustace. Well, maybe except for you. You're out there on the East Coast time zone, so I know it's awful late for you. But I thoroughly have enjoyed you being up tonight. And again, that offer every Friday night until you are weary of being on my show, and I pray that doesn't happen anytime soon, I'd like to have you up. So you've got that slot filled as long as you desire, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Rose, are you still with us?
Yes. That zip code, was it 24401?
Yes, that's the code.
Okay, and let me ask you about the Federal Reserve. The different presidents appoint those seven board members at different times. Do they get a short list of who to appoint? Can they appoint a taxi cab driver? What are the qualifications?
No, they have to be important bankers. Out of Wall Street or a Wall Street connection, and the president himself, of course, doesn't know any of these people. They are recommended to, the names are given to him by the bankers themselves. He has absolutely no choice whatsoever.
Was Alan Greenspan a banker?
He was a partner at J.P. Morgan.
Oh, okay, a partner. Okay, so really each president, when they say, oh, the president appoints the chairman of the Fed, he has only seven choices, right?
That's right, and yet they say that the Federal Reserve System is independent. They always talk about the independence of the Federal Reserve System. They're independent of the American people, but they're not independent of the bankers.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, indeed.
Well, you're welcome, Rose.
Okay.
And, folks, for those of you who are going to catch the show on the archive, once again, I'd like Eustace to give out the information where you can reach him and order some of his fine books. And, again, tonight's interview was based on The Curse of Canaan.
Yes, well, it's the Bankers Research Institute, which is at P.O. Box 1105, Stanton, Virginia, 24401.
Okay, and what does Curse of Canaan cost? Isn't it $15?
$15. That's a deluxe hardcover book.
As all your books are hardcovers, aren't they?
Yes, indeed they are, yes. Because due to the improvement in printing, I found a few years ago that I could print hardcovers for practically the same price as paperbacks, because I have kept my prices low over the years because I want as many people as possible to get these books.
Well, we sure do appreciate it. And, you know, Eustace, I do believe the time is coming where educational resources are going to finally be recognized as being much more of value than having a good supply of bullets.
Oh, definitely.
Which I don't think is a bad idea either. But the fact is, it's a weapon that gets greater through the giving. Folks, that's truth. That's the nature of Christ. It's the only gift that gets greater through the giving, and you can't ever exhaust it. Believe me, folks, you can run out of bullets. I think these resources may be here during a time when things get very dark for this nation, and you'll find, folks, that you'd be more willing to lay your life down to protect and disseminate information like this than even to hold on to your weapons. So, Eustace, I want to thank you for joining us, my friend, and let's give it a talk sometime next week and discuss what we're going to go over on next Friday's show. Okay, my friend?
I'll be looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Eustace. God bless.
Thank you.